This is Creepy and Geeky, a part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcast Network. Welcome to Creepy and Geeky. I'm your host, Robert, and on today's episode, we're continuing our series on What's Your Favorite Double Feature. On today's episode, Preston Fossil returns with a couple of lesser-known movies, Psychopath and Angel, Angel, Down We Go. Preston is an award-winning novelist and journalist whose work has appeared in Fangoria, Rue Morgue, and Scream Magazine. His books include Our Lady of the Inferno, The Despicable Fantasies of Quentin Sirgunov, Landis, The Story of a Real Man on 42nd Street, Beasts of 42nd Street, and Necessary Death. Welcome back to the show, Preston.
Thanks for having me back. I've been looking forward to it for a while.
Yeah. We've been trying to schedule it for quite a while, actually. But both of us would, every time something came up. So it's been a year, and you had two books come out last year, which really, were pretty big and set you out on book tours and stuff like that. So that was a lot of stuff that, kind of tangled with the scheduling. But, here we are. It's been good. You were one of my very first guests on the show, and it's great to have you back.
It's always fun being here, and I've really been looking forward to talking about these two.
Yeah, these two we talked about, honestly, it's been probably over a year since we talked about doing these two movies together. So that's what's funny about getting back into the double feature aspect and having guests bring me their double features, because this really was one of the ones you wanted to talk about big time. You previously were on for the first one we did, which was Mumsy and Goodbye Gemini.
Yeah.
And so those two were really, really obscure, really crazy ones. And actually, so far, it's still my most popular episode in terms of listens. It's great. And hopefully this one will become really popular as well.
I hope so too, because like Girly and Goodbye Gemini, Psychopath especially is one of these movies that I feel very passionate about and just want to share with everyone. And Goodbye Gemini and Girly at least managed to get themselves legit DVD releases. Angel, Angel, Down We Go has one, but the Psychopath remains in gray market purgatory in terms of a legitimate DVD release. And whoever puts this out, Vinegar Syndrome, the Severin, they're just going to print money with this thing.
So these are definitely very bizarre, very I had never heard of either one of these. You always bring me weird stuff, man. It's always the most bizarre stuff. But they were interesting. I'll give them that. Let's go ahead and start. We'll go ahead and start with The Psychopath, which is a bizarre a Mr. Rogers style kid host who, this is the setup. He, kills the parents of, he kills the parents who are abusing their children. So he sees that kids are being abused and he goes and murders the parents, gives them their punishment. That's a kind of the bizarre setup. Tell me why these movies are the movies you brought to me.
So Psychopath, to me, I pitched this movie to people as imagine Death Wish, but instead of Brosnan, it's Mr. Rogers. And that's just such a cracked setup and not quite like anything else I've seen before. Like the vigilantes in these 70s and 80s revenge movies tend to be these stoic, strong, silent types, or these rampaging killing machines. And you've got Sylvester Stallone and Cobra, you've got Bronson and the Death Wish movies, you've got a smattering of independently released, oh, you got Rolling Thunder, and it's always these tough guys. And you never see the vigilante being like this squirrely, like weird, like almost infantile guy who is very clearly meant to be Mr. Rogers.
Right.
And he also kind of presages Pee-wee Herman a little bit. I was surprised to
Yeah.
find out that this actually came out before Paul Reubens ever did the Pee-wee Herman show. And it's just utterly fascinating to me is this singularly weird piece of cinema, even in the gonzo world of 1970s drive-in and grindhouse movies. I can't really quite compare it to anything else. It's got this
Right.
really unusual tone to it. The soundtrack is very interesting. It shifts between like children's television music and like this like California surf rock whenever the cops show up on screen. And it's just bizarre. And then the performance of the main guy, Tom Basham, just really blew me away the first time I saw this, and it continues to impress me every time I've seen it because you really believe that this guy is cracking over the course of the movie.
Yeah.
Because he starts out already seeming like he's teetering on the edge of reality. And then as the movie goes on, this guy just goes absolutely fucking bonkers. And he is swinging for the fences.
Yeah, there's definitely a weird quality to him. There's it almost, I think, in today's like viewing, I could see him as being on the spectrum, on the autistic spectrum. Just in the way that his like just his childlike demeanor exists at all times. You know what I mean? Like other than when he's like, going out and killing somebody. He always had that like kind of, it didn't seem like an act, it just seemed like who he was. And so it seemed like, and not to say that, all autistic people are like that at all, because they're not, but that just kind of felt like that could have possibly been a play on that. But also it was kind of in that it, like you said, it presaged Pee-wee and kind of Michael Jackson to a degree, in that kind of like childlike way that they saw the world. So it was definitely a weird way of playing the character, for sure. Because it's a it, to me it felt like, he identified with the children so much, because he felt kind of like he was one still. That's how it came off to me.
Yeah, every time I watch this movie, I get a different read off the character. And I'm never quite sure like what his deal is and
Right.
whether or not the Tom Basham had a I don't know if it's Basham, Basham, whether or not he had a concrete idea for this character in his head, whether he was playing it different in different scenes, whether the writer director had a concrete idea. But it's like there's these moments where, like you say, it's like he still sees himself as a child and very much identifies with the children, and that's why he feels so strongly about doing what he does. But then he also kind of seems to like live on his own and be independent. And he's a piano prodigy, apparently. There's that scene where after I think it's the first murder, he goes back to the movie studio and plays like the sonata on the piano. And I'm just never quite sure. And I feel like that's a great quality to a movie that it rewards a rewatch because you can pick up different things and get different ideas about what makes this guy tick.
Yeah, it's definitely a movie that I can see is one of those ones that you, if you rewatch it, you're gonna pick up different things. It's not available anywhere, like you said. It's not available anywhere. I had to watch it on YouTube, a really bad copy on YouTube. Both of these movies weren't available on any streaming service. And Angel, Angel, Down We Go was actually on the Internet Archive, so it was definitely search these out if you're interested in what we're talking about. But yeah, this movie is so strange. I found it interesting too that one of the cops in here later on becomes Sergeant Taggart in the Beverly Hills Cop series. So that it cracked me up every time I saw him on screen because it was just like, because he's literally playing a very similar cop that he plays later on. And it just was like, okay, this is like in my own internal logic, I was just like, this is where he began.
I have never picked that up, but as many times as I've seen this now, granted, I think I've seen Beverly Hills Cop like maybe two, three times, but I have never made that connection before.
Oh yeah, I had just rewatched the Beverly Hills Cop series for the first time in a long time, not too long ago. So it was still fresh enough in my mind that when I saw him on screen, I was like, "Wait a minute!" And again, this is a not very good copy on YouTube, and so I was just like, "Is that him? I think so." And so I had to look it up, and yeah, it was his very first movie.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, it is pretty funny. But yeah, no, this movie's interesting. I this is one of those times where I really think this concept would benefit from a remake or a like taking the concept and making a new movie, a modern day movie out of it. I think that it would be, you know, if you could still go, you know, keep to its inherent weirdness, I guess. But I think it would be an interesting movie for somebody to take and maybe remake for like Shudder or Screambox or something like that. Probably not something that it would hit a theatrical release, but definitely something that would be a good thing to add to a streamer like that.
Yeah, I really think that this is the time for this movie to be rediscovered because Mr. Rogers has so much love right now. Like, I can't go to the mall and pass a store like Lunchbox or what's the other one? Not ThinkGeek, they're gone now. But you know, all of these collector stores that sell like
Yeah.
pop vinyls and like lunchboxes and stuff, and there's always Mr. Rogers merch there. And you know, there's all these Mr. Rogers memes on the internet. They made that movie a couple of years ago. He's got tremendous cultural cachet right now.
Yeah.
And I just think you tell somebody, here's a movie about Mr. Rogers as a vigilante serial killer. I mean, that would sell all the tickets, all the DVDs right there.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I think, and again, I do think it would benefit from a remake because this movie itself, you know, definitely is a product of its time. And it's not, to me, it definitely wasn't the best in terms of everything. But again, maybe if there was a cleaned up version of it through something like Vinegar Syndrome or Severin or whatever, then yeah, possibly it would look a lot better. But I think, you know, it definitely suffers from just being from its time period. And I think a more modern storytelling could make the story benefit really well from it.
And I'd also love for it to get back out there because I'd love for the main actor, Tom Basham, Basham, whatever, to get the appreciation that he deserves.
Yeah.
It's a very mysterious person. He was in a slew of television series in the 1960s and early 70s and appeared in a couple of exploitation movies, a biker movie called The Pink Angels, and then this one, and apparently made a couple of late in life appearances in some like direct to DVD movies in the early 2000s, 2010s. But other than that, there's not a lot of information available online about him, and he died unfortunately in 2010 at the age of 68. But I would just love for somebody to have their inspiration sparked by this guy and to like dig up his life story because I would just love to know more about this guy.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it definitely would be interesting to get a little bit more information on. I was just trying to look it up on IMDb again, but I think it's always because it goes by a couple of different names, and I think on IMDb it actually goes by its other name, Eye for an Eye.
Yeah, so I believe that Eye for an Eye was the original theatrical release title. And then when it went to home video in the 1980s, because it did have a VHS release, which is how I first saw it. I used to slash might still own the VHS that I got at a closing down Hollywood Video for like $5 back in 2004. But when it went to home video back in the 80s, the name went to Psychopath. And I
Interesting.
believe that it ran on the drive-in circuit slash grindhouse circuit under a couple of other names as well. But the Psychopath and Eye for an Eye are the two biggies that it's you can find it under. But for
Yeah.
whatever reason, it's one of these movies that got that initial home video release to VHS back in the day. But during that transitionary period from VHS to DVD, there's apparently some kind of rights issue involved, or the rights holder just isn't interested in releasing it to home video. Something interesting that I discovered just several years ago when I was researching another one of these movies that might be interesting to talk about one day, called Who Killed Teddy Bear with Sal Mineo, is that a lot of these classic exploitation and drive-in movies, the current rights holders are just investment corporations who bought up the companies that were the previous rights holders, and they're just sitting in the laps of people who don't know what to do with them. Their main businesses may be in like stock trading, and they bought this company because it had good stock value, or they were going to liquidate it, and now they own the rights to movies and records and books, and that's not their stock and trade. They don't know what to do with it, and they don't care enough to look into what they could do with it. And so there's all these great, or at least weird and interesting movies like Psychopath that are sitting in the hands of people who, don't realize what they've got.
No, and I think that I've seen that a little too often over the last few years, especially of people trying to get the rights to some of these movies, and sometimes it's these investors, like you said, and then sometimes it's somebody out there who has the rights who isn't necessarily connected to it originally, but somehow got the elements and everything, and is just sitting on them, trying to get as much money as possible. And people are just not doing it, like, because they want too much for it, and it's not worth because a lot of times these elements need to be run through and fixed, and because the film stock itself isn't in great condition still, because it's been quite a few years.
Yeah,
And
there's like this. Yeah, you talk about the low quality of Psychopath, and probably whatever you saw on YouTube is probably actually what it would look like if you popped my VHS in right now.
Yeah,
Even
exactly.
the original VHS did not get a really great transfer. There's actually like scratches visible in some scenes of it where they just took a reel and transferred it to VHS.
Oh yeah, no, I think that the transfer that's on YouTube is probably a direct from VHS transfer based on the quality of it. It definitely felt like an old VHS transfer. So it's unfortunate and frustrating that people who have these movies are just sitting on them like that. And there's definitely the companies like we've mentioned, Severin and Vinegar Syndrome, who this is their stock and trade. They would be, and there's other companies, Second Sight, Umbrella, a bunch of different other companies out there who are doing the same thing. And that it would be so beneficial to them and to everybody else to have good quality versions of these, but these people are sitting on them and asking way too much money for them.
And it's sad. And then there's also a case that I've encountered too. There's a smaller, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but upstarts who are trying to get up off the ground, and they get a little overly ambitious. And I'm not going to name any names here because I think that everybody involved had good intentions. But there was a particular movie that had an announcement for a DVD back in the early 2000s, late 2000s, early 2010s. And the press release went out, X company is releasing X movie. And I was just like super excited. and they dragged their feet on it. They really didn't know what to do with it. And while they were trying to figure out what they should do with this in terms of a DVD release, both the director and the star of the movie died. And they did have the opportunity to interview them to potentially get a commentary. I know there was a point where the actress was actually on standby, like just waiting for them to give the word. And she was going to get on a plane and come out there and do the commentary. And it sat in development hell with this company for, I want to say, 5 to 7 years. And then finally, when they released it, the transfer is beautiful. They cleaned it up. It looks better than I'd ever seen it look before. But the special features are completely bare bones, and it's just because they were overly ambitious. And could they acquire this movie for release? Yes. Should they have done it? Probably not, because they didn't think, here's all these people who are involved who are still alive. I think even the cinematographer might have died in the interim. But it was just a sad situation.
That's a situation where it's like, we may not have the time or the money to do the cleanup of the transfer yet. But that's where you go, okay, well, for now we're gonna go out and we're gonna get all the special feature stuff and gather all that. So that way, once we do get the transfer complete, then we have all this material. And you see that, like we've said, the places who are doing this, I mean, even Scream Factory, I mean, Shout Factory, they do very nice additions, and you're starting to see it. The people are putting out some good stuff. Unfortunately, some of the studios are still putting out these crappy bare bones discs. I can't believe the Evil Dead Rise came out with nothing on it, and it took like, and then it was like, and just like in the Evil Dead fashion. Just a few months later, a new version of the disc came out in a steelbook with a commentary and a short featurette. It was just like, just down the road here, at some point in a few years, there's going to be another one that we're going to have to double dip on. But it's even sadder when it's like movies like this, where it's older. They've sat on nothing but VHS this whole time. And it's going to be really bad when. I mean, you've seen it with some of the discs that have come out that were stuff that were shot in the late 80s, early 90s, the shot on video stuff, where it's not the greatest quality, and there's only so much they can do to clean it up. And that's what I fear is going to happen with a lot of this stuff. Either it's going to be lost time, or once they do untangle the rights or something like that, the elements are going to be so bad that it's not going to be worth it in the long run. I mean, it'd be worth it to preserve it, but there won't be, it won't be in the in a in as good a quality as it could have been if people had gotten off their butts.
And then like I said a second ago too, you lose the people that were involved. Like I, it really hits me. I first saw a lot of these movies in my late teens and early 20s, and it strikes me now, maybe they weren't that old then, but they're really old now. Eye for an Eye, I just realized, is 41 years old. And what are the odds that a lot of the people involved with these movies are still going to be alive by the time you can get around where you could actually interview them or give them a commentary? Looking at the information on the director and writer, the writer of Psychopath, Eye for an Eye, was born in 1937.
It's just unfortunate. It would really benefit, a lot of the movies we've talked about, that you and I have talked about specifically on the show, would benefit for sure from people just kind of getting off their butts, and the people who own the rights just kind of releasing it. And that's what's frustrating. And like you said, with the people who are investors and stuff that buy up these properties just to kind of sit on, it doesn't make any sense. It's like, what's going on? And I'm sure listeners have seen this happening. The David Zaslav, the guy who runs Warner Brothers Discovery now, he's literally deleting movies for a tax write-off instead of releasing them. And it's like, why? Like, it's just like, it doesn't, it baffles me that, going for this tax write, he obviously doesn't care about movies. Like, that's the thing that comes down to it more than anything else, is that He absolutely 100% does not care about movies. He has shelved three movies now that we know of, that were either complete or near completion. And it's ridiculous. And I mean, it's been so bad that now, like, they're starting to like look into it like for tax fraud because it's like, why is he doing this? So
I know about Batgirl and Wile E. Coyote. What's the third one?
It was a sequel to the Scoob movie. It was almost complete.
I did
So
not know that.
yep. Yeah,
Huh.
it was pretty bad. And like it's th three movies that would have done well-ish. You know, because Batgirl was pretty hyped. It was supposed to be another return of Michael Keaton as Batman in that one. And obviously the Coyote versus Acme one was that one was that one is complete and has gotten anybody who's seen it, test audiences and people who got to see it raved about it. They all thought it was great. And it's ridiculous that it's getting shelved because he wants the tax write-up because they when it was complete and Warner Brothers said they weren't going to carry it. They allowed the filmmakers to shop it, and lots of places were interested in it, but not for the price that they that Zaslav set for it, which was $70 or $80 million, and nobody was going to pay that price for a movie they weren't sure was going to make that much back. So,
Man, if you
but
would have dropped that into movie theaters at Christmas time, that thing could have made from like what like exactly what you said, like everybody who's seen it just raves about it. I mean, that could have made all the money. Put that out for the Christmas holiday. Oh, yay.
Yeah, no, he seems like the kind of person who just literally hates movies. Like he comes from the discovery side of things. Like he, and so like he's trying to, and like they've deleted stuff. Like they don't have, Westworld on Max anymore. So you can't watch that. I mean, you could still watch it other places. You can buy it through Vudu, or you can buy the discs and stuff. So it's not completely gone, but it's one of those situations where, like, why not have one of the more popular shows from HBO on your service? It makes absolutely no sense. It's like he just pissed off at having that kind of material on his, networks now. He's all about the reality shows and crap, and it's like, that not going to make money in the long run, people. Come on. So
It's
it just
sad.
baffles me that whole like and the whole streaming mentality now. And don't get me wrong, I kind of fell into it like, what, 6, 7 years ago myself, where I was just like, well, everything I own is on Vudu at this point. I'll just buy stuff on Vudu and whatever else I can just watch through streaming means. And that's how a lot of people have gotten. But I, luckily fell into the horror side of stuff and started buying stuff through Scream Factory and everything. And then I was just like, you know what? I actually want all the discs of things that I really care about. And that way I don't have to worry about if one of these services fails, then, I don't have to worry about that. But yeah, it's just, movie preservation at this point is fully necessary because it's starting to have issues. Because not only that, but you also have the problem of when they go to streamers, they're taking stuff out or they're re-editing things. And it's just like, I think we need to, these movies need to be saved in their original
Yeah.
formats. And put out at least on a disc that people can put in their collections and have some kind of backup for. So, and these two movies, are a prime example of that, of something that we don't have good copies of. Even if they're weird movies and stuff,
And they need to be preserved.
they need to be preserved in every movie, even the weirdest and crappiest things. It's just They need to be preserved. Even the 80s and 90s direct-to-video stuff, somebody out there likes that stuff. I mean, Vinegar Syndrome and Severin have made their whole like business model off of preserving that kind of stuff. So it's just like it's completely necessary. So
Oh, hopefully somebody's listening to this and will snap up Psychopath.
hopefully, somebody somewhere is making inroads towards that and some of these other movies that we've talked about. Yeah, this it's an interesting movie. I don't think there's a ton to say about it because it's a fairly simple setup and it just kind of follows along with that. There's not, I wouldn't say there's a ton of nuance to it or hidden meanings or anything like that.
No.
But like you said, it's Mr. Rogers as in Death Wish, you know. It's just a guy having, getting revenge for these kids who are abused. And it is an interesting topic though, because it's very much a, it was 1973 when this movie came out. And look, I was a child of the 70s and 80s, and we still got our butts beat in public. You don't see that anymore because, times have changed and people realize, physical abuse of your children is not good. Number one, and two, in public, it's even worse. But yeah, in like this movie is just like it's unflinching. These parents are horrible and they're beating their kids in public and nobody's doing it, doing anything about it. And it was an interesting thing to go back and watch and see a movie where somebody did go back and do something about it.
Yeah, off the top of my head, I don't think I can think of another vigilante movie centered around child abuse. There's the Rape Revenge movie, of course. There's the just straight up revenge movie, stuff like Taken, or The Beekeeper, which if anybody's listening to this, The Beekeeper is way more fun than you would expect. If you like cheesy action films and you just want to kill an hour and 20 minutes of your life, go see The Beekeeper.
Oh, The Beekeeper
But
is great. I love a
it
Jason
is, isn't it?
Statham. I love a Jason Statham movie. It was like, it's got its own little social message there. And it but it's just a straight up just great action flick. Just watching Jason Statham tear through people is always fun to me.
It
So
was great. But yeah, I cannot think of another vigilante child abuse movie.
No, I can't think of anything. You would know better than I would, but yeah, I can't think of anything that even came close to this kind of subject. And it's definitely interesting for that. If any of what we've said, like, sounds mildly interesting, definitely go watch this because it's while it's not the greatest movie, it definitely has some interesting things going on in it, and it's definitely worth a watch for sure. Did you have anything else to say about this one before we move on?
No, I think we're ready to go on to what is somehow the even stranger entry in this double feature.
Yes, definitely. Now, and this is Angel, Angel, Down We Go, which is the title of a song. That's in the movie as well. This one also goes by different names. Do you remember what the other
Yes.
names are?
Cult of the Damned is the one
Cult
that
of
you
the
can
Damned.
actually get from Kino Lorber.
Okay.
I don't know if it's still available, but I do own a Kino Lorber DVD under the title Cult of the Damned. Speaking of streaming services and the sh shifting nature of them, I actually first watched this one on Netflix back in the day
Wow.
under Angel, Angel, Down We Go, back when Netflix had a bit more of a diverse catalog and was showing weirder stuff like this.
Right. Yeah, I think when we originally talked about it, it was on Amazon Prime. But since then, it's not anywhere but on the Internet Archive. So you'll have to look it up. And I think it was on there as Angel, Angel, Down We Go. Yeah, this is a bizarre movie. Why don't you go ahead and tell us about the setup of what this is about?
So it is about an overweight debutante in the 1960s who comes home from boarding school and falls in with a cult of rock musician skydivers. It is one of the stranger movies in my collection in terms of being able to classify or quantify it. It's very strange, and it came out of a very specific period in 60s filmmaking. It's killing me now. There's this French New Wave director. Oh my God, I'm gonna kick myself. It's not Truffaut, it's the other guy, the one I don't like. Godard. Okay.
Oh yeah.
It's like somebody like watched a whole lot of Jean-Luc Godard movies and then decided that they were going to fuse that with 1960s hippie movie culture,
Yeah.
like I Love You, Alice B. Toklas with Peter Sellers. It's a very 60s movie. Somebody once joked that Michael Mann's Manhunter was so 80s you need padding, and Angel, Angel, Down We Go, Cult of the Damned is so 60s you need padding. There's lots of shots of like painted collages and
Yeah.
like just like lingering shots on like different people just like languishing in different positions while they like recycle political talking points. And one of the things that I picked up on rewatching this for the podcast is it's a funny thing is that it's a cult of super capitalist right-wing hippies
Yeah.
who are very open about the fact that they want to join the establishment and that they want to be rich, while at the same time doing everything else that hippies do, like dropping acid and wearing feathers and leather vests with no shirts underneath and spending all day playing like psychedelic rock music.
Right. So this is the description of the plot on Wikipedia. It says the overweight, emotionally troubled daughter of an affluent but brittle Hollywood couple becomes involved with the charismatic rock singer and his friends. The
I
singer
wrote
per
that.
Did you for
Yeah.
real?
Yeah.
The singer
Yeah.
proceeds to seduce and manipulate her entire family.
Yeah. Editing Wikipedia articles is a hobby of mine.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah. That's my summary.
That's funny. But yeah, no, I mean that's a very fairly apt description. Although, like, that's the funny thing too, is like I guess in 1960s, 1969 when this came out, this actress was overweight. I don't think she'd be considered overweight in today's standards. She'd be maybe mildly chubby. Because she's
Oh,
really
sorry.
not like maybe in the face, but body wise, she's dancing and moving around and everything like that, and she's not really that like overweight, I guess. And it I guess from my perception, I wouldn't have called her overweight at all. So
It seems like such a big plot point in the movie though, like
it
people keep
is.
bringing up like how big she is and like and I really it is like it really just does demonstrates a cultural shift in beauty standards and in body positivity and in what we consider to be overweight. And I think one of the big things is that this came out at like the height of like the Twiggy look where
Yeah.
like looking almost anorexic was considered the most desirable thing. And like you say, this woman is maybe at most like 10, 15 pounds over what would be considered a healthy weight at most. And yet everybody in this movie is just constantly ragging on her for her weight.
Yeah, it's like it's ridiculous. Like not only her parents, but like everybody. It's just it is really bizarre. This her parents are this bizarre couple who like the dad is possibly gay. He's definitely gay, or at least bisexual. I would say that he's definitely bisexual, and that creates a rift between him and his wife. And for some reason, that makes them send the daughter to an overseas boarding school. And then she comes back after she turns 18, and the whole movie is set upon this setup that. At her coming out party, that's where she meets the lead singer of this band. And it's a bizarre setup. It's just a bizarre movie. It, like you said, there's the long lingering shots on collages, and with like voiceover narration about everything that's going on. It was written and directed by a playwright. So I kind of, and it was in his sole directorial credit, according to the Wikipedia that you probably wrote.
Yeah, the really interesting pedigree for this movie. So his name was Robert Tom, and he actually wrote several well-known grindhouse and exploitation movies. This is the guy who wrote the original Death Race 2000. He wrote a really great movie called The Witch Who Came from the Sea, which starred his then wife Millie Perkins, who played Anne Frank in the original film adaptation of The Diary of Anne Frank. Witch Who Came from the Sea is a trip. If you want to see Anne Frank running around cutting dudes' junk off with a razor, Witch Who Came from the Sea is the movie for you. And then he also wrote a couple of drive-in staples, Bloody Mama, and what's the other one? It's also got Mama in the name.
Crazy
Bloody
Mama,
Mama,
according.
Crazy Mama. Yeah, Bloody Mama and Crazy Mama. And then in addition to that, this movie also has a early appearance from Roddy McDowall. As part of the rock cult, Lou Rawls is in here, and you mentioned earlier that one of the songs is called "Angel, Angel, Down We Go." This has the distinction of being a horror rock musical, and all of the songs in the movie were composed by Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, who were a tremendously successful songwriting duo, and you have definitely heard one of their songs. They co-wrote "You've Lost That Love and Feeling" with Phil Spector. They wrote, let's see, I'm just going to pull up their list. They wrote for Gladys Knight and the Pips. They wrote for Ray Charles. They wrote for the Partridge Family, apparently. Make Your Own Kind of Music. That's been featured in a lot of movies and TV shows over the years. They wrote "Here You Come Again" for Dolly Parton. They wrote for Paul Revere and the Raiders, "Hungry." And they had tremendous success going all the way up to the early 90s. And I have no idea how the hell they got involved with this because they were successful at the time that this came out. They had already released. Well, they didn't release, but the Righteous Brothers had released "You Lost That Love and Feeling" a couple of years before this came out, and so I have no idea how this, incredibly commercially successful pop songwriting duo got roped into, well, this.
And I mean the songs in the movie are, fairly good and catchy enough. It's definitely interesting enough, I would say. I found it interesting too when looking into the information on this movie and the main actress, who's Jennifer Jones. She became a folk artist and activist. That's where most of her work has been since that time. She's done some acting throughout the years, but mostly does a lot of activism and folk singing, owns her own label as well. For that kind of material. And apparently she's I think she's an aunt to Kevin Bacon.
Wow.
Yeah, it was interesting. Oh
There's
no, not
some.
Jennifer Jones. I'm sorry. It's Holly Near. Sorry, my bad. Holly Near, the main actress, sorry. The one who was the fat girl, which was not fat. But yeah, she's done a lot of, yeah, she's an American singer, songwriter, actress, teacher, and activist. So she's done a lot of activism over the years. And that's where most of her work has been.
It is a weird movie. I know I keep saying
It
that.
is. No, it is like it's you always bring me the weirdest stuff, dude.
There's like skydiving sequences. There's like two like actual skydiving sequences. They got like real skydivers and like photograph them from a biplane.
It is like that's what makes this movie so bizarre. It's like this weird, like you said, this musical French like funky movie mixed with Point Break style skydiving sequences. It's just, it's so bizarre because they rope the girl into like flying the plane for them because they're all skydivers. She's not a skydiver, but she knows how to fly a plane weirdly. And so they're like, well, you fly the plane for us and we'll jump out of it.
Yeah,
It's
that's
like,
something that, yeah.
it's
Sorry, go ahead.
no, I was just gonna say, it's just the most bizarre setup for a movie. It like, I can see, I don't know how successful this movie was, but I can see it not being very successful, just because it's such a bizarre tone and quality, and the story is just kind of all over the place, that it just baffles me that it even got made. But again, like, I've seen so many other movies that have gotten made for who knows what reasons.
That's what makes this the kind of the odd man out for me in Tom's filmography in terms of the stuff he wrote is Death Race. I can see okay. It's like Demolition Derby, like taken to the extreme, and like car
Right.
chases are cool. Which You Came from the Sea is a rape revenge movie that came out, you know, right there in the, I hate to say the golden age of rape revenge, but kind of,
Yeah.
and it had Millie Perkins in it, but. Cults of capitalist hippie rock and roll skydivers
Yeah.
is, yeah. Something that really jumped out at me is that I would have sworn that this was meant to be a piss take on the Manson family. And the
But it
first couple of times
predates
that
them.
it predates them.
Yeah, that's it. It's interesting. Yeah, it was. I think you had mentioned that to me when we were talking about it before we watched it. It's just like, yeah, it's a interesting, like, it's almost like the Manson family took their cue from from this movie.
Yeah, it's weird. If you've read about the Manson family and then you watch this movie, you would swear that this came out after the Tate LaBianca murders and that this was meant to be making fun of them. There's just so many parallels and so much about their aesthetic and the way that they behave and the fact that they devolve into murder. And then it's like, no, it's like this guy saw something coming.
Yeah, that's and I think that's either prescient on his part, just that he saw something in society that something like that would happen, or just he got lucky and kind of happened into foretelling that. So I believe it's probably more the former, because it was probably one of those things where, if you're observant enough about society, you could see something like that coming down the road.
Yeah, and I think that he probably just did.
But yeah, it's a bizarre movie. I like, it's neither one of these are movies that I think I'll watch again, which is usual for most of the stuff you bring me. But I think they're more interesting to talk about than they are even to watch. Because of how bizarre they are and the circumstances of how they got made, that it's just, it's more interesting to tell the stories around the story. They're definitely worth a watch. I definitely wouldn't say they're not worth a watch. So if anybody's interested, definitely go check them out and let us know what you think.
Yeah, this is the thing about both of these movies. Neither of these movies are movies that I'm going to pull off the DVD shelf, sit down, and watch by myself. I own them for preservation purposes, but and then when I watch these movies, it's because I'm showing them to somebody else, and I want to share that experience with somebody else so that they can know that this thing exists. The last time that my brother visited for the holidays, I showed him Angel, Angel, Down We Go. I've shown friends of mine Psychopath, but these aren't movies where I'm just like, I'm bored or I can't sleep at night. Let me pop this in.
Yeah, no, definitely. If it hadn't been for you bringing them to me, I don't think I would have, one, ever known about them, and two, ever watched them on my own otherwise. So, but yeah, no, they're definitely interesting. And I think they're definitely worth a watch. Maybe watch them with friends if you can, just so you can, have that kind of talk about them. But they're definitely just, they're so bizarre, that I'm not sure You know, like you said, they're good for having this the preservation aspect of, and I feel that way like with a lot of movies, especially again, a lot of the stuff that Vinegar Syndrome and Severin put out, like sure there's some nostalgia factor for some people with some of these movies, but I've watched some that people are just like, oh my God, this is such a great classic movie. And I watch it and I'm just like, this is a piece of trash. And I don't want to watch this ever again. I get why you like it. It's there's probably some nostalgia in there. You watched it on videotape back in the 80s. But you know, and I have that stuff too, don't get me wrong. But I just yeah, there's definitely, you know, these are movies that while interesting in their ways, definitely not something I'm gonna watch again anytime soon. But yeah, no, it's this one, like I said, this one's just so weird because of you know, putting it into the modern context of things. Like we said, everybody's just giving her like so much hell about her weight, and she's really not fat at all. At least according to our modern standards. I mean, here's the thing. If anybody's seen Argylle recently, Bryce Dallas Howard, in that is not thin. She's not fat, but she's not thin in that movie. I would argue that she's probably actually a little bit heavier than this woman is in Angel, Angel, Down We Go. And she just carried a major, you know, blockbuster style movie. So, you know, so it's just interesting to see the changes in our views on weight and everything, and just see how like badly they were just giving her so much crap about it in the movie. It was painful to watch at times.
And even the mother, it's like supposed to be this plot point that she's like this washed up over the hill hag who like nobody wants anymore, and the band is able to manipulate her by playing on her insecurity about her looks. And she's stunning. She's a gorgeous older woman.
Yeah. Well,
And
and two, it's a weird plot point too that she made adult films too. And it's like they're it's such a weird, bizarre movie. It's like that's how the whole crux of the relationship is the man is like the father is like possibly gay, but probably just bisexual. Because him and the wife still have a sexual relationship together. But like they constantly are talking about her past as a stag film actress and that she had so many men and everything, and that like it plays on her insecurities, but that is like the worst, like everything about this plays on the worst like aspects of like digging at these people. And it was just weird.
now, there is a cultural value to it. It is a very interesting time capsule
Yeah.
of societal views at the turn of the 1970s.
Yeah, and I do think that I like we said that I think if you go in watching it for the interesting aspect that it predates the Manson murders, that and understanding that it predates it, and but how much it kind of parallels in some ways that kind of aspect, that it's interesting for that aspect as well. But yeah, I mean they're interesting movies. Both of these movies are very interesting in their own ways. Again, I think they're more interesting to talk about like around them than, you know, and what they are and how. And I think it would be really good to preserve them and have those movies available for people to view and kind of get that chance to check them out. Whether or not you like it or whatever, you know, that's always up to subjective opinion, but it's definitely something I think people should, you know, go check it out. If anything we've said makes you interested, definitely go check these out. Anything else you want to say about Angel Angels that we hadn't said yet?
I think we've covered all bases.
All right. Well, it was definitely great having you back on again for another weird ass double feature. We'll have to get you on again for some more weird movies.
I am already thinking.
I'm sure you are. But yeah, definitely let people know where they can find you online.
I'm mostly on Twitter these days, although I'm staying off for anything except really promotional purposes. I'm giving myself a very concentrated social media break this year, but if you want to catch any updates on my writing, you can find me on Twitter at Preston Vossel.
All right. Excellent. All right. Well, again, thank you for coming on again. And hopefully we'll get you on sooner than this last time. Because we did, we did try to get you on here and there. It just, time got away from both of us with both of our schedules. So, but yeah, no, it's been great fun talking to you about some crazy weird movies again.
Thanks again to Preston for joining me. On Friday, Ashley Wahanko joins me to talk about season one of Loki. And on Monday, Donna is back to talk Ganja and Hess and Scream, Blackula Scream. Thanks for listening. Creepy and Geeky is a part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcast Network. Please check out morbidlybeautiful.com/podcasts for more great shows. If you like what you've heard, please consider giving the show 5 stars and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Also, please share the podcast on social media to help spread the word. Make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app or at creepyandgeeky.com. Music for the podcast is Gratitude, composed by Harper Smith. You can follow the podcast on social media at Creepy and Geeky on both Twitter and Instagram. If you'd like to follow me, I'm GeekThulu on Twitter and Geek.Thulu on Instagram. You can support the podcast by ordering teas and more on TeePublic or by donating to the Ko-fi page. All of the links are in the show notes. Finally, don't forget, stay creepy.